The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We don't really know, do we, what an escalating cyber war would look like, or do we?
We've seen Russia target the energy grid in Ukraine in 2015, 2016. They launched a massive attack for ransomware called NotPetya that actually caused over $100 million in damage to FedEx and a number of other companies in literally just a few minutes. So, you know, the damage component of this is really bad. And, you know, they have the ability to target our critical infrastructure. They've been targeting it for years.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It raises a big question, doesn't it? Officials in the U.S. are continuing to warn businesses to be on the alert to suspicious activity from Russia on their networks. I wonder what is coming our way. You know, I would think, you know, it's only logical to think that, like, we saw what happened with the Colonial Pipeline. Remember when that got locked down, what it did to gas prices up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and how ransomware had to be paid and had to be done in crypto. And, you know, I think we're going to see situations similar, if not worse. The targeting of power grids and even small businesses, they're saying right now. So my question, let's just look at this for a few moments. I mean, Russ White's going to be stopping by. We'll get his take on this as well. We may not see a kinetic war. We may not see missiles drop in the U.S., but will you see a cyber war? And what will that do to you if you can't, if you're without electricity for a while, or running water, or transportation gets halted, or the banks go down, or the internet gets cut off? You know, a week before Russia physically invaded Ukraine, before they rolled in with their tanks, there was a sudden cyber attack on the government. You know, all their websites were hit. And so were their banking and their other commercial sites. And it was a pretty clear indication that Russia was going to physically invade Ukraine, even though Vladimir Putin said, these are just military exercises. We are not going to invade, right? That's what he told the world. Meanwhile, there's a cyber attack, and then they roll in, and we see the devastation. He's turning that country now into rubble, into dust. It's a terrible situation. But what did Russia do? They tried to disrupt the critical communications. Why? Well, they wanted to make it easier for them to take the country. If you can do that, it gives you an edge. It's obviously, it hasn't been that easy, but the cyber warfare right now continues. The problem for us is that Russia isn't going to limit this to Ukraine. Remember last year when they hacked that, you know, the control systems for Colonial? We saw what happened. It cost millions of dollars in restoration costs. That's just one pipeline, right? Fortunately, the federal government is a follow-up to that story, a little side note. They paid all this money in crypto. They were able to ultimately track down most of the money and restore it, so that's good. But, you know, the hack served, I think, as a wake-up call, an ominous warning, if you will, that our infrastructure is vulnerable. It's dangerously vulnerable to being shut down by hackers. And look, Russia has some of the best in the world. Last week, the EPA issued a warning to a lot of operators of water purification plants and sewage treatment plants. You could be next. You could be targets of these sorts of attacks. I don't know if you're in the city of L.A. or Chicago, if you are in Philly or down in Houston or wherever you're listening to me right now. Imagine if the sewage treatment system got shut down, or worse, your water. Fortunately, you know, we have a relentless enemy in Vladimir Putin, and he will be targeting our country. So you got to be aware. How do you respond? That's going to be the key. There's a former general counsel of the NSA, the National Security Agency and Central Security Service, suggested in a New York Times article that the government establish a central cybersecurity authority that would standardize our defense, and it would be adaptable to various industries. I'm joined today by Russ White. He is well-known in terms of the computer networking world. He's an advocate for simplicity and privacy, and he co-authored a lot of software patents and books and video training in computer networks, and his book is called Unintended Dystopia, and it's good to have him back with us. By the way, if you want that book, check it out on Amazon. Russ, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. How are you today?
I am well, and I'm looking forward to the conversation and to your expertise, because I am concerned. I know that there's been an increase in cyber activity already against certain targets here in the States, and those are probably only going to ratchet up, and it's maybe an inevitability that one might get through, but maybe for those who aren't familiar, maybe you can lay out the groundwork for us. How vulnerable are our computer systems here, And how likely is it that we might see an intensification of attacks?
Well, if you listen to the security folks that I know, our systems are pretty vulnerable in many ways. Now, there are ways they aren't, but it seems like that there are ways that our systems could be DDoSed or broken into in various ways and taken down. And I should mention that a lot of times these types of attacks are not promulgated, or they don't come directly from the outside. They come through social engineering, they come through spear phishing attacks and things like that, rather than just a direct, like, I'm going to overwhelm your website with traffic. These people want to take out water systems. They don't want to just take down the local city's website.
Yeah, that would be crippling if they were able to take down, a water system, or they were able to take down our power grid. Same type of thing could happen. I'm assuming that our defenses are getting better. How vulnerable are we to the infrastructure? That concerns me really more than banking or anything else. I mean, if the power grid was to be hacked, or water or sewage was to go down, it could bring this country to its knees pretty quickly. How vulnerable are we, Russ?
Well, it's don't downplay the threat to the banking system either, because it's quite often true that if banks can't pay for bills, that the water gets cut off automatically. It would take manual overrides and a lot of work to bring things back online. And so, attacking the banking system itself, particularly in the form of clearing out payment processors in some way, would actually be pretty effective for a lot of these things. How vulnerable are we? It's really kind of town by town, municipality by municipality, and that's part of the problem. Is some places are more vulnerable than others. Some people have paid more attention than others, and it's not really that larger towns are better off than smaller or anything like that. It's just a matter of how much time and effort they put into thinking through what might happen. And it's almost security in this area is almost kind of a whack-a-mole type thing. Mm-hmm. Like you pick up a lot of different ways of doing things. And then, you discover that they found new ways in, or you discover that you've deployed some new Internet of Things technology, some new thing in, smart meter or something like that, that has vulnerabilities that you didn't look into because it's all new deployment. So it's very much a whack-a-mole type game, and it's really hard to judge the actual position of any particular system without doing a lot of in-detail research on them.
So from your expertise, how likely are we that in the month ahead we're going to see some sort of cyber attack here in the U.S.? That will be successful.
Well, we're already seeing
them. Let me qualify that.
We're already seeing them. Yeah, we're already seeing them. Successful ones, it's very hard to say, but I would say we'll probably see one or two, and then people will panic and start actually doing something about it. That tends to be just the way that we run the world, isn't it? We just like, oh, wow, they actually succeeded. Now we've got to go do something to stop this kind of attack, right? Just like we did with Pearl Harbor and other things. We kind of wait until there is some serious threat. Now, NIST and others have been, CISA and stuff, have been pushing, doing things to try to harden things. But it's just, it's a matter of time before an attacker finds a way in. And by the way, a lot of the problem here is not really exterior defenses. It's really personnel training, right? It's like you get some email, some employee of a water system gets an email. They click on that link because they think it's perfectly legitimate. And all of a sudden, the attacker is inside the network. And, a lot of companies and a lot of organizations don't really have the mechanisms to deal with this kind of stuff.
We see it here at Relevant Radio. Our IT department here has given us so many different training sessions on what not to look at. And it's amazing how these hackers, how clever they are, how they make it look extremely official, might even come from a high-ranking, person at the network or something along those lines. And if you're not paying attention or you're not careful, you can really open the door. And look, we're a radio network. We're not the electric company, right, or the water supply or some food chain or the Colonial Pipeline. So you can see how this happens. Let me ask you a simple question, and it might be ridiculous in terms of even asking this, but, the targeting of water treatment facilities, electric plants, I get that. I know the ramifications of that, and that's what they want to target. Do they go after the average citizen as well? Do they want to target home computer devices? Do they want to go after Alexas or other devices that they can somehow hack into, listen, or is there anything beneficial or meritorious from doing something like that? And are the citizens vulnerable?
Well, it would depend on the person in question, right? If you happen to hold a key position at a company, well, then, you know, your private network is just as vulnerable or just as close a good hacking point as any place else into your life and to get some social engineering in. The second thing is that quite often these devices like televisions and computers and stuff like that can be used to launch larger attacks. There's almost daily some sort of new report on a huge new distributed denial of service attack that's taken place because a new class of devices have been found defective or had security holes that opened up a huge amount of reflection traffic that took down a certain network or something. Now, you know, again, some of these systems like water systems and stuff really aren't necessarily attached to the internet globally. They are air-gapped from the global internet. So DDoS isn't necessarily something that you get into, but more and more they are attached to the global internet. And, you know, even if you start looking at something as simple as, any large major corporation like Amazon, like suppose you could take down EC2, you might not take out the water supply, but if you could take it down Amazon, not just the Amazon shopping site, but the Amazon cloud, you could take down pretty much every company in the U.S. overnight and just bring economic activity to a halt. Might be just as effective as shutting down the water supplies.
No, you're absolutely right. And we've never seen something like that, but I am sure that there are bad actors right now that are trying to do just that, and we'll see what happens. My guest today is Russ White. If you've got a question or a comment, I only have a few minutes left with him today. I'll open the phones and take your calls. The number here to get in is 888-914-9149. If you're joining us just now, we're taking a look at the potential for coming cyber war, cyber attacks, and the areas that it would hit, not just the Pentagon, you know, not just military targets, but water, electricity, banking systems, and perhaps, you know, even individuals. I think it was a fascinating point. I never really thought about how vulnerable somebody with some credentials could be and how weak their home network might even be. This idea of a centralized governmental cyber authority, it sounds great. Are there drawbacks to it, and will we see something like that?
So there's already some degree of that in the industry. There are groups that work together, either within or outside the government, to try to help build security into the internet. The downside is, I don't know if you read The Federalist, but there's been some stuff about a couple of cyber groups that were participating in bringing down a U.S. president or trying to figure out what was going on with the U.S. president in the back end. And, you know, there are dangers in that any of these defensive tools can also be used offensively against groups that are on the political outs. And so that's always something that needs to be managed. It's just like any other police force, anything like the FBI or the CIA or the NSA or whoever else, their power is pretty great. And if it's not properly managed, it can be turned against individuals in a very bad way. Another problem with centralized types of things is that centralization brings a level of fragility or brittleness. You see this attack 1,000 times and you think, well, that's the only kind of attack there is. So you build systems around it, whereas much more distributed defenses are more people or individuals are more willing to say, yeah, maybe this is something different. Maybe I need to try something different. And so you chew up a lot more stuff. I mean, it's the same thing we see in the medical profession, right? Centralized medicine tends to be very brittle, right? It reacts the same way to anything, masks and lockdowns and whatever it is, and, you know, mass vaccination or whatever. And just maybe that's not always the right solution. Maybe individual doctors on the front line might be providing information that we're not paying attention to for whatever reason. It's going to be the same thing in cyber warfare. You're going to have these situations where, you know, the centralized authority says X, but that's not really what's going on. So there's a level of brittleness in there as well.
Gotcha. All right, let's go to RJ. He's listening in San Francisco. RJ, you're on the air with Russ White. Good afternoon. RJ, go right ahead. All right, let me go back. I'll put him
in. Yes, I wanted to ask you if you think we should start stocking up now and preparing for this, you know, because the war is on right now and we don't know where it's headed. So I was wondering what you thought about that, you know, stocking up on groceries.
Yeah, it's a great question. Russ, do you want to handle that?
So that's a hard question for me to answer. Because at a personal level, I do some of that, but, you know, you can always go overboard with it, too. Mm-hmm. And so it's really difficult to know the answer to that, because I just don't know. It's going to depend on your personal situation. There are a couple of books out there that talk about this type of stuff. I just saw one came out. Here's how to prepare your, disaster ready home. And there are several checklist books and things like that that talk about this type of thing. And I think I would defer to those rather than trying to give an answer myself.
Yeah, you know, I've seen, there used to be a show for preppers, and no matter how prepped they were, you know, there was never enough to meet the situation. However, to your point, I don't think it can hurt. And the reason I say that is, I mean, how much can you really do? I have a little extra, you know, food in the house, some beans, rice, canned goods or something. If my neighbors needed it, I'd be able to share with them, you know, and get them through a day or two. I'm sure the government would eventually set up stations to find, you know, relief to people who are really suffering in those particular areas. But, you know, you should have extra water, whether it's a cyber attack or whether it is a natural event. Power can go out. Storms can knock things out. Acts of God like earthquakes. So, you know, have a little extra food, something that, you know, last you a couple of weeks maybe, and some water. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's prudent. But like you, Russ, I mean, where do you draw the line? How far do you go? Do you need generators? You know, do you need, you know, materials to clean your water? I mean, some of these preppers have so much stuff, and sometimes that may not even still be enough. So, but it's a good question, RJ. You're not alone. A lot of people think about that. Russ, I know I have only a moment left, so let me get some final thoughts from you on this issue as well. So maybe before we wrap it up, anything you want to leave us with?
Not really. I mean, it's all about flexibility. It's all about taking personal care. Don't click on links yourself. You know, have good security hygiene in your own personal life, and that will spread. And if you're an IT person, you know, really try to get to people and help them understand the importance of cybersecurity in your organizations. And even if you're not in IT, you know, that's something you should be pushing upstream if you have any influence in your company at all. And, you know, just be prepared the best that you can. A lot of it's attitude. It's not just about having things on hand. It's about attitude as well. And just, you know, be ready for whatever happens.
Never realize. Well, Russ, my gratitude for you. Good to have you here. People want your book. I'm assuming the best way to get that is simply going online to Amazon?
Yep. Yep, Unintended Dystopia, a new one's coming out pretty soon, Unfriending Dystopia, and I'm starting work on another one, but that'll take a couple of years, so we won't talk about it.
All right, well, can't wait for the next one. We'll have to talk about it when it hits the shelves. Thanks for being with us. It's great to have you with me today.
Yep, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
You got it. Well, stay with me. When we come back, we can talk more about that. Maybe the days ahead, I'll talk a little bit about should we prep or should we not. You know, I'll do that next week. That's a great conversation. And if you're having trouble sleeping, stay with me. I'm going to be joined by a sleep expert. We turn the clocks forward this weekend. Can you believe that? We're going to spring forward. How much sleep is enough? And have we forgotten an ancient practice that was done in medieval times? I'll tell you what they used to do. Don't go away.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
I think many of us in the modern world, we expect to be able to dive into bed at night, switch off the light, and we think that sleep is also just like a light switch, that we should immediately be able to fall asleep. Well, unfortunately, sleep isn't quite like that for most of us. Sleep as a physiological process is much more similar to landing a plane. It takes time for your brain to gradually descend down onto the firm bedrock of good sleep. In the last 20 minutes before bed, or the last half an hour, even the last hour, disengage from your computer and your phone and try to do something relaxing. Find out whatever works for you, and when you have found it, Stick to that routine.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, let's talk sleep. I think it's an important thing. Hey, this Saturday, you turn your clocks up. And don't forget to do that. Of course, you spring up and you fall back. And I thought, you know, there are some people saying, look, we don't need daylight savings time. It's a thing of the past. We should probably get rid of it. Why do we have it? We can talk about that if you want. We can take a look at that. Is daylight savings time helpful? Is it the American Academy of Sleep Medicine made the case that the U.S. should eliminate daylight saving time in favor of just a year-round standard time? Some experts agree. We'll talk about that. And then my other question to you, too, is I don't know how well you sleep. If you get up in the middle of the night, if you are able to, to sleep a good 8 hours, how much sleep do you actually need? How much sleep is enough sleep for you? And that's a really important question. Quite often, I think people get too little sleep. I think our high school kids get way too little sleep. I think it affects their academics. But there was an interesting study that was done, just like eating and drinking and breathing, sleep is really important. But thanks to social media, thanks to our electronics, thanks to all, you know, the technology we have today, I think we're getting a lot less than it. Here's an interesting weird little fact you can throw out to your friends this weekend. All animals sleep, right? But did you know that a dolphin, for example, it sleeps with one eye open? Only half of its brain snoozes at a time. I just read that this morning. And that's probably because dolphins need to be partly conscious to breathe while in the water. Zebras sometimes sleep standing up in case they need to wake up very quickly and escape a predator. Bats, as you know, they sleep upside down, right? But when somebody's asleep, it looks like they're turned off, right? They're not doing anything at all. It's really not true. Your brain, your body is still active. In fact, you're doing some important things when you sleep, like organizing nerve cells and regulating hormones and repairing cells and clearing out toxins. And your brain is especially busy, you know, things like processing your memories and giving you those insights and learning new skills. So we'll talk today. How much sleep do you actually need? And babies need 4 to 17 hours. That's why they sleep so long. How much do high school kids need? How much do you need as you age? I've invited to join me today, longtime friend of the show, Dr. Lou Tartaglia. He's an expert on sleep, and he joins me around this time of year, a couple times a year, actually, to address a lot of these different issues. And it's good to have him back with us today. He's a full-time sleep medicine specialist, board certified as well in psychiatry and neurology. And you can check him out online. We'll get you a website and get you plugged into him if you want to tap into his services. Doctor, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
No, it's good to be back.
Always good talking
with you. I'm looking forward to the clock going forward because that's the easier time of the year. There's less problems with doing that.
You're not as tired, are you, as in the fall when you lose that hour? It's kind of wild.
Right.
So Sunday, for those who don't know, we get out of bed an hour earlier. So if you're going to go to Mass, you know, I just want to make sure everybody's well aware of it. But for some 70 million people, that lost hour compounds, right? I know there's more accidents with daylight savings time and a whole lot of other things. Your thoughts on it? Fill us in. I mean, why is it important? What's the history behind it? And how does it affect us personally?
Well, I think the real history behind it was during World War I, they wanted to be able to have more light for the factories. And so they decided to do the daylight savings time, and they could run the factories later on, later in the night without the electricity, and they could get more production going. But in reality, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has been pushing to just have a standard time year-round, which is the healthier way of doing things. And hopefully they'll eventually get rid of it. Although when they did surveys, everybody wanted to stay on daylight savings time because there was more light in the evening, and I guess people wanted to be more active outside. The standard time is the better way of doing it. Just go back to the way it was before we invented all this. The guy who started daylight savings, and I can't remember his name, was an avid golfer, and he wanted to be able to golf in the evening. And that's what started him on this campaign. And then he used World War I as the kind of excuse to get it going.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's a little bit of information I never heard of before. So the big avid golfer wants a little more daylight. I can see that.
At 2 a.m.
on Sunday.
Work, you could go to the links.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. So we turn the clocks back in the middle of the night, or whenever you go to bed, you can do it. But 2 a.m. is when the clock officially rolls back that hour or springs forward. What's it do to the body? I mean, I had read before that accidents increase. There's all sorts of other problems the next day.
Right. In the fall, the accidents go way up. So it's the falling backwards and losing the hour is actually a lot worse. In the spring, we do much better with it. Hmm. So this isn't as problematic as what happens in the fall.
But, that's great. Well,
you know, your circadian rhythm is kind of like set in stone. You get up in the morning, the sky blue light triggers things on your retina that triggers the shutdown of the melatonin, and the clock resets. And then we mess it up for about a week. Everybody's a little bit messed up from the change in time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Is there an appropriate time? You're the sleep doctor here, too. And let me just open the phones. I know a lot of people struggle with sleep. Daylight saving time can mess that up a little bit too, whether we turn it forward or backward. If you want to join us for the conversation, I will open the phones for you. My guest today, Dr. Lou Tartaglia, and he's a sleep medicine expert. If you want to dial in, it's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. There's some things that you might be doing that are keeping you awake or making it difficult for you to go to sleep too, so we can talk about that as well. But is there an ideal time, doctor, for bedtime? 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock? Is it earlier? Is it later? Does it depend on when you get up? What do you do?
It really depends on when you get up. You want to be able to allow 8 hours in bed. You know, 7.5 hours of sleep is ideal. And, you know, half hour for falling asleep or, pillow talk with your spouse, that sort of thing. So depending on when you have to get up, you're going to adjust your time. Some people have to get up a little bit earlier. Most people around the world go to bed somewhere around 10 to 11 and get out of bed between 6 and 7 a.m. And that seems to be the standard worldwide.
Let's also talk about how much sleep we actually need. I was reading that babies need 14 to 17 hours of sleep. You know, you've often heard 7 to 8 is ideal. I don't know, as you get older, if you need less. Some older people seem to sleep a lot less. What is the ideal night's sleep? I mean, how many hours should we bank?
Yeah, after 25 years old, it's 7.5 hours. And as a matter of fact, if you look at people who live into their 90s, most of them were people who consistently slept between 7 hours and 15 minutes and 7 hours and 30 minutes a night.
Oh, wow.
So that's considered the ideal. Now, there are some people who are short sleepers. They wake up and they're fully refreshed and they get by on a lot less sleep, you know. We have a couple of doctors that only sleep about 4.5 to 5 hours a night. They're both surgeons here in town. And they get more research done because they have a 3 extra hours a day. But there aren't very many people that are like that, that are truly like that. There are a lot of people train themselves to sleep less, but they're sleep deprived chronically.
Do these surgeons of yours take naps?
No, they're just are naturally short sleepers. Yeah, they're 4 hour sleepers, and there's only like one or two of those per million in the population.
Yeah, I'm not one of those. I like a good night's sleep, and when I don't get it, I'm grumpy. That's for sure. Patricia is listening in Reno, Nevada. And if you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. Hi, Patricia. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you, Drew, for taking my call. My question for the doctor is, I'm wondering, like, for night shift workers or people who chronically sleep late, like my elderly mother actually sleeps late, like around 8 or 9 a.m. and wakes up, like, maybe after 4 to 5, 6 hours of sleep, and so I'm just wondering, if that is chronic, does that have a association with a higher incidence of breast cancer? I've heard something like that. I'm not sure, though.
Well, the shift work is associated with GI problems and increase in medical problems, but most people are working shifts, aren't going to bed 7 days a week at the same time. They're shifting back and forth, and that's a lot more stressful on the body. So it's better if you're going to work a shift to make sure you go to bed the same time 7 days a week. And, you know, nobody has really successfully shifted back and forth like that and stayed healthy. You get mostly GI problems, but there's a higher incidence of cancer for people who have sleep disturbances, and there's a higher rate of cardiovascular disease. But it's not real clear, and it varies from individual to individual.
Okay, so disruption of the circadian rhythms doesn't necessarily is not necessarily associated with higher cancer incidence of cancer. The disruption of circadian rhythms.
Not necessarily.
Rhythms.
Yeah, there are some people who claim that it does, but it's not a real clear relationship. The clearer relationship is with GI distress.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, doctor. Thank you.
Sounds great. Hey, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. My guest today, Dr. Lou Tartaglia, will take your calls if you want to join us. 888-914-9149. Before I go to that, let's do some fundamentals here, too. I know a lot of people struggle to get enough sleep, and sometimes they go to bed and they say, I'm just not tired. People keep their phones next to their bed. They sometimes watch television. Sometimes they read on their iPad or tablet, or they're checking their email on their phone. Blue light. Let's talk about the effects of blue light, because I think kids really are susceptible to this more than anybody, any demographic that's out there. What does that do to helping affecting one's ability to actually fall asleep when they go to bed?
Well, there's a certain cell on the retina that measures the blue light, and what it does is it resets the circadian clock, and so being exposed to blue light late at night messes with your circadian clock. So there's a thing called cryptochrome receptors, blue light receptors. They've got a lot of names, but there's these cells that read the sky blue light. So in the morning when the sunlight comes in, the blue light actually triggers the retina, and then the retina triggers the shutdown of melatonin, and it restarts the circadian clock and lets you know that the day is starting. So people who come home and they're working nights and they come home at night and they're working, they come home and get exposed to light in the morning. If they're not wearing blue blockers after working at night, what happens is their circadian clock gets reset. And then they have trouble being able to fall asleep and stay asleep during the day. So blue light is really important. Sky blue, it's the color of the Blessed Virgin's robe, actually, yeah, if you look at it. And it's the key to getting your circadian rhythm entrained to the daylight cycle.
Well, I often think, Doctor, about naps too. I mean, there's some people, if you take them, you don't necessarily need to sleep, do you, to rejuvenate during the day. You can probably, I had read somewhere, if you even close your eyes for 10 minutes and just sit really still, and you don't necessarily have to go to sleep, but that would be beneficial. How important are naps to our body and to our health, to our cognitive abilities as well?
You were designed to take a nap in the afternoon. God gave you a circadian dip. You're supposed to eat most of your calories in the middle of the day. And then what happens is you take the nap in the afternoon, and then it restores you and you're able to work into the evening. That's the ideal. And most of the world is on that schedule. In the United States, in England, in Australia, we're not on that schedule. And it's a lot harder to function. So naps are really important. And we're talking 45 minutes to an hour and a half. Between 2 and 4 in the afternoon.
Yeah, you know, Doctor, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I want to pick up on that point, because I had heard, I don't know whether it was Einstein or whether it was Tesla or one of these great inventors, who would only, they'd only sleep for a very small period of time. They'd sleep for 4 hours.
It was Edison.
And, It was Edison. You know what I'm talking about? Let's talk about him when we come back, because there's also this forgotten medieval habit of what they call two sleeps. And for millennia, people slept in shifts. We'll talk about that. We'll take your calls and questions. Just a few moments left. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. I'll even share with you what Saints did. Don't go away.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Sweet dreams till sunbeams find you. Sweet dreams that leave all worries behind you. But in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream of me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
What a perfect bumper, Maggie. Great job. It's good to be with you today. If you're just joining me and maybe a little tired, you know, I have to be at my peak when Dr. Lou Tartaglia says, most of us want to take a nap. You know, I'm on in the midday, and it can be kind of tough. If you're having trouble staying asleep, if you're having trouble sleeping in general, I do invite you to feel free to dial in and join us here. I'm joined by a sleep medicine expert. Right now, there are millions of Americans who suffer from chronic sleep disorders. I saw one number that 20 to 30 million people have intermittent sleep-related problems. Maybe you wake up in the middle of the night, you just can't get back to sleep. Some of the stats are staggering, too. The average American sleeps for about 6.9 hours each night, which is a little bit higher than I thought it was. It's less than that 7.5, which is optimal, according to Dr. Tartaglia here, and a lot of other sleep experts. But 3/4 of American adults say, they struggle with this. So if you've got a question for the doctor, we're going to invite you into the conversation. You can join us, 888-914-9149. And, doctor, let's go right back to the phones because this final segment goes very quickly. Angela in Southern California, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. I was calling
about I heard that if you are pre-diabetic or if you are on your way to diabetes or even diabetic, if you sleep more than 9 hours, that can be a precursor. Is that true?
That is, actually. There's some research that shows that people who are long sleepers often have difficulty with their glucose metabolism.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So, you're saying
all sorts of interesting things going on here. Yeah.
Yeah,
so long sleeping is just as bad as short sleeping. Once you get past 9 hours, it's a problem. And once you go below 6 hours, it's a problem.
Thank you very much.
Why is it a problem to sleep too much? Thank you, Angela. I'm fascinated by that because why is it bad to sleep more than 9 hours? I would think that the body's doing its regenerative type of activities. What does 9 hours plus do? I mean, you say 7.5 to 8 is perfect, but if you go beyond that, what happens to the body?
Well, I don't think it's what it's doing. It's the fact that you're needing more than 9 hours of sleep says there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about you need to look at it the opposite way. It's not so much that you slept 9 hours because you shouldn't be able to sleep the 9 hours. So that's a sign that something is off.
Let's get to this glucose issue. There's a lot of people who struggle with that. A lot of people deal with obesity. I think if they're able to get their glucose levels under control, they might be able to lose that weight. Does obesity link you to, you know, the desire to sleep longer as well? How does that work?
Well, I don't know if that's true, but just intuitively, it would make sense. But I don't know if there's any studies that actually demonstrate that. We do know that you secrete a hormone when you're sleeping. It's called mesfatin-1. It's a satiety hormone. So the longer you sleep, the faster you're going to get full. But after a certain amount of time, there's too much of it. It doesn't seem to work. people with a lot of NAD fat and are skinny, people with not enough are heavier. So if you sleep 5 hours one night, you need to be awake longer, you're going to need more calories, but it's going to take you longer to get full.
All right, we'll go back to the phones. Michael's going to join us here. Before I do, let me just sneak one final question here for you, or another question that just came to my mind. Can you catch up on sleep? People say, hey, I'm only getting 6 hours, 5 hours, I've got this deficit. Is it possible to catch up on lost sleep?
Sure. So let's say you have a really short night, and then you decide you're going to catch up the next night. The next night, you'll generate more slow-wave sleep and non-REM sleep, and you'll catch up on that. And then the following night, you'll generate more REM sleep and make up for the REM sleep you missed. So for every short night of sleep that you have, it takes two nights to catch up.
All right, well,
so obviously you can't sleep all during the week and make it up on the weekend. It's impossible.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. I thought you couldn't really catch up on that lost sleep, but that's good news. Michael in San Antonio, Texas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, hey, Drew, and thank you for taking the call. So my comment was I heard just as you came back from the break that 7.5 hours was optimal. And I've recently done some research. I've been an active and adult all my life. I'm now 60, but I still work out 8 to 10 hours a week. And I'd like the doctor to comment on the need for more than 7.5. I'm reading closer to 9 and even 10 is optimal for athletic people. To take that time to rebuild, and of course, you know, no food a couple, 3 hours before you go to sleep for the same reason, so that your body can go into this resting state. So I'm going to take the call off the air so I don't get in an accident out here in San Antonio. Thank you, Bull.
You got it. Drive safe. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, see, right, I don't know of any studies that show that you need 10 hours if you're working out really vigorously. I haven't seen anything on that. That's interesting. And if it would be anywhere, probably in the sports medicine journals, which I normally don't read. I guess the harder you're working out, the more slow wave sleep you need in order to restore the muscles. So, I can't address that issue.
Maybe that's part of the reason. You're working out, your body's got a greater demand. I don't know. Maybe a little bit different than the average person, but... Who knows? We'll go to Dave in Reno, Nevada. Good question, though, Michael. I'm grateful for it. David, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. The question I had was spring forward is a lot more tougher on the body than falling back. And I'll give you a quick example. If you have to be at work at 9 o'clock and before spring forward, you may get up at 7:30 to go to work at 9 o'clock. When you spring forward, suddenly it's 8:30. But your body's used to 7:30 until you get used to it over a week. So it's much harder during spring forward for everybody I've talked to. What do you guys think?
Yeah, actually, I think the opposite is true. I think people tend to gain an extra hour. And when you gain the extra hour, you actually do better. So,
I understand what he's saying. It does make sense. If you got to get up
earlier.
Yeah,
but it's not a gain. Yeah. It's a loss
of an
hour.
No, it's a loss.
Not a gain of an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. You lose an hour.
Dave,
I'm just trying to tell you, everybody I've talked to, they have a lot of trouble with springing forward. Falling back, you get an extra hour.
Yeah. All right. Well said, David.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I stand corrected. That's
thank
true.
You, guys.
Okay. That's a great point. I always get it confused, to be honest with you. I can never remember. I just know when... You know, when you got to get up a little bit earlier, it can be tough. You lose that hour, I guess, because you go to bed at midnight, you know, and the clock moves up an hour. So if you get up at the same time, you do lose a little bit of time. Dr. Alcohol, I want to talk about that because a lot of times you like to have a glass of wine at night or sip on some whiskey or whatever your drink might be. Alcohol is a big no-no before you sleep, right? A lot of people think, hey, I just needed to relax, take the edge off.
And like and a nightcap or something, yes.
Yeah, is that okay or
actually,
not?
It's really not. What happens is you wind up waking up more frequently during the night when you have alcohol at bedtime.
Why is that?
It sedates the brain just a little, and then it wears off, and then the brain starts to wake up, and it gets a little bit more excitable, and you wind up having a nocturnal awakening about four to five hours after the drink.
What if you drink heavy? Then it really messes you up?
It really does, yeah. Although a lot of people who drink heavy, they say, oh, no, I'm doing fine. I wake up right on time. Well, what they're really doing is they wake up because the alcohol is worn off.
That's so funny. That's so true. All right, my guest, Dr. Lou Tartaglia. We'll take a few more calls. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Irma in Cameron Park, California. Hi, Irma.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question regarding my son. He's 12 years old, and he's always having a hard time falling asleep, but I try to make him go to bed early and try to make him sleep at least 9 to 10 hours. Is that too many hours?
No, not for that age.
I heard that you said 9 hours. Okay.
Yeah, teenagers
that would
more
be for
sleep,
an adult.
9 to 10, she's talking about, but teenagers too. Let's expand the spectrum here a little bit. They need a lot of sleep.
Sure,
don't
like
they?
A 15-year-old needs closer to 8.5, 9 hours.
I would think they need
a 12-year-old may need 9 to 10.
Yeah. Wow, that's pretty much. We talk about what happens during the brain. You know, you say, hey, you look like you're totally out, but really the brain is, you know, it's shuffling things, helping the memory. There are these. There are people who believe you can sleep learn, like they want to learn a language or they got an exam the next day. Your conscious mind is off, right? Can you sleep learn? What studies have been done in terms of saying, hey, I want to learn Spanish or Italian? Can you listen to tapes at night or something along those lines and pick anything up? Or is that just, that's just not true?
I think that's an urban myth. I don't think it works.
And there's no studies or evidence
I haven't seen any studies that demonstrate that works.
Everybody would be doing it, I guess, if it worked, right? We'd all be speaking multiple languages.
Would be. Right.
You know, from a spiritual perspective here, too, I just want to look at prayer. Because prayer, you know, they've done these MRIs when people pray the rosary, when they go into deep prayer, what happens to the mind and what happens to the body. What does prayer do if you decide to spend some time before you go to sleep? For example, if I was to wake up in the middle of the night and I began to pray either the rosary or the chaplet, I find myself out again. Like the rosary is like an insomniac's, you know, prayer in some respects, because when I start praying the rosary in the middle of the night, I can't get through it. What about the role of prayer and sleep? Is there a connection there?
Yeah, I think it's really important, actually. You should have a good prayer life, but if the devil woke you up in the middle of the night and you start to pray, he's going to allow you to go back to sleep. Mm. And if God woke you up because he wants you to pray, you start to pray, you're doing the right thing. So I think we should just keep it real simple that way.
Well, that's wonderful. Before we run out of time, I have about a moment left for you. Advice for those who have trouble getting to sleep. Your final sleep advice, doctor.
Yeah, you know, some people, there are courses in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. A lot of the universities have them online. And you do like 6 sessions and then you practice the techniques. And over the course of 3 to 5 years, sleep gradually improves. And people who do cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia generally do better than people who take medications.
Oh, fascinating. Well, doctor, thank you. People want to get in touch with you. What's the best way to do that?
Well, I guess if they needed to make an appointment, they could call my office. But, I'm in Toledo, so I don't think anybody in your listening area.
Well, doctor, you never know. They may want to tap into your expertise, but I appreciate that. They can track you down. And
not a problem.
Get some good sleep tonight, doc. We'll talk again. I always appreciate your time. All right. Dr. Lou Tartaglia there. I got to take take a short break. I wish I could. I'm done. That's it for me. Kel Clark's coming up. You can hang out with him. I'll be back again on Monday. We'll look at some of these issues we talked about today that we can get to. I like that whole idea of prepping. Hey, I'm going to pray for you this weekend. I'd appreciate your prayers as well. Until next time, have a great day.